Thank you for having me here. I'm going to share my screen. And hopefully this can all see the slides. So as Guy said, thanks for the introductions. I'll be talking about the phenomenon of lexical semantic change. So that's a phenomenon by which words change meaning over time. And given my past experience in lexicography, this was actually the first time I came across this phenomenon from a professional point of view. If you're old enough like me to remember the times before the internet, you may soon relate to this picture here, showing how the phrase surfing the web on the web just didn't make any sense in the 90s. And that's because both the verb surf and also the noun web just didn't have those meanings at the time. And so this is a phenomenon that lexicographers know very well, because dictionaries are the first place where people look for, one of those places where people look for meaning of words, and they need to be kept up to date because language changes all the time. And thanks to innovations in technology, but also changes in society, historical events, and also language internal mechanisms, words change their semantics. And this is a phenomenon that, of course, has happened throughout history. It affects all languages. It can be observed in historical languages. For example, the word bully started off as a term of endearment. If you look at the entry for bully in the Oxford English Dictionary, you see the first meaning is the oldest one, and it is a positive meaning. But then we're all familiar with the current connotation of bully as a negative term. So this just shows an example of a word that underwent a long spanning change. And like bully, many words have experienced the same, and lexical semantic change has been studied by linguists for a long time. We know that it is a complex phenomenon that interacts with the language external factors, as I mentioned, historical, social, technological factors, but also language internal mechanisms. And people have studied, you know, the mechanisms and the relation between old and new meanings, and how typically new meanings tend to coexist with old ones before possibly taking over or just continuing to coexist. So there is a lot of interest in this topic, and I'd just like to show how varied this interest is in between disciplines. As we just heard, interdisciplinarity is a very important aspect in many topics, and this one in particular. So if we divide this topic into contemporary and historical data sets, just for simplicity, we can say that most research on contemporary short-term lexical semantic change has been done obviously by linguists, or also computational linguists who are interested in keeping up with the pace of language change, and particularly semantic change, for example, when developing systems that somehow need access to the semantics. Think of sentiment analysis systems that judge whether a text is talking positively, negatively about an entity. Some of these systems rely on lexicons and lists of positive, negative, and neutral words. So these lists need to be kept up to date. So having an awareness of semantic change is really important, and having the option to automatically identify semantic change becomes really, really useful. And social scientists also are interested in these methods because they allow us to trace how society is changing, and how people's attitudes and opinions are also changing. On the other hand, historical data sets and semantic change in a kind of more historical perspective is obviously interesting to historical linguists, but not only to them. Librarians, for example, can make use of this research because if we can develop reliable systems that I trace meaning as it changes over time, then we can improve the experience of library users when they search historical collections. So for example, if they're looking for the expressions, the linguistic expressions of a concept over time, and they can retrieve the text that realize that concept, even though they're doing it by using different words over time, that's certainly gonna make the experience much richer. Lexicographers, of course, it's their job to trace these changes. And with increased availability of digital collections, it becomes really, really critical to be able to make use of these collections at scale and to combine automatic and manual methods. And digital humanists, more generally, historians, conceptual historians, intellectual historians are very interested in tracing semantic change as a way into reconstructing the history of concepts and ideas. So I hope to have made the case that this is a very interesting and stimulating topic of research. And this has certainly attracted interest in the natural language processing and computational linguistics community just over the last few years, really. This is just a small sample of the growing number of papers that are dedicated to proposing different ways of extracting, detecting semantic change from texts. And I was part of a team that organized a shared task to try and put a bit of order in this really rich and growing landscape. So there were all these different systems that were trying to do more or less the same things, detecting semantic change, but there wasn't a way to compare them to each other. And so we put together manually analyzed corpus for four different languages. And that really attracted a high number of teams. It was 133, if I remember correctly, that really took part in this, I'd like to call a competition, even though there wasn't any award. But the idea was that they could all be evaluated against this same gold standard that we put together. And this helped the community to really realize how far we've come, but also how far there's still to go. So compared to some very simple baselines, the best model on average on all languages though has an accuracy of around 70%. So it's definitely better than chance and better than simpler baselines, but it's quite far from close to the accuracy that we would want for close to human performance. So there's definitely room for improvement. And so I was looking for where this improvement can be found. So I'm going to take you through a journey over time and across different languages. This is how I spent the last 4 years looking at semantic change in ancient languages, but also in contemporary texts. So first things first, I'll start with ancient Greek, silly, the oldest language I worked on. And so the idea of this project was to start from models that had been proposed for much more recent texts and modern languages. So corpora of English covering the 18th to 20th century, and see what happens when you apply them to ancient Greek and how you can actually improve them. So we had to put together a corpus of ancient Greek for this, and so we called it the Diaresis Ancient Greek Corpus. And I'm just showing you this table to give you an idea of the composition of this corpus. So this corpus covers quite a few centuries, obviously all the texts that we could find available for ancient Greek. but also covers different genres. And as you can see, the distribution of genres over time is all but balanced. Some centuries only have one or two genres, others have most genres. So this is really the reality of working with ancient texts. Don't have the luxury to pick a corpus that is nicely balanced with a good balance between genres and centuries. So we have to embrace this this skewness. And so what we came up with was an intuition. So on the left, you see a visualization of a model that was proposed in 2016 by Leah Fremen and Mirella Pata. And it was a variation of topic model that just purely based on word concurrence statistics applies Bayesian learning to estimate the probability of different senses of the same word over time. So the different colors correspond to different senses of the word power in this case, and you can see that they change over time. And this is all nice, it makes a lot of sense, but for ancient Greek, the intuition was that we couldn't really do without an awareness of genre, because it's true for any language that variation and change coexist. So variation, for example, across genre, it coexists with change over time. But it is particularly true with ancient languages for the reasons I mentioned before, the characteristics of their corpora. So so we changed the model by adding this genre layer. So that meant that for every time period and every genre, we could come up with, or the model could come up with an estimate of the probability distribution of different senses over time. And I'll just take you through an example of a word, paraidesis. It's an interesting word. It's a Persian loan word, and it changes meaning from garden to paradise around the time when the Old Testament was translated into Greek and of course, the New Testament. So it's a subtle but still important shift. And because, of course, paradise is a garden of Eden, so it's a type of garden, but still it is a definite change. So what happens when we run our model through this, this word? So we first have to identify these topics or senses that come out of the model as really lists of words. And you can see at the bottom here, you have these four different groups of words, which can be grouped into the two groups, paradise and garden. So the blue and the purple colors correspond to the newer sense of paradise, the religious sense of paradise, and the green and yellow, which has really low probability, are for the older sense of garden. And that we differentiated between religious and non-religious texts couldn't go at a high granularity level, just simply because we didn't have enough data, but so we kept it at this distinction. And I should also say caveat that for the very first time span, we have our model is struggling a little bit because we basically only have Homer and only one genre. So the purple that you see on the top left is actually a little bit of a unexplained estimate, but the rest makes perfect sense. And so if you can see in both plots, the blue bars tend to appear around the time of the third century before Christ, and then later on in the Christian era. That's the time of the Old Testament Greek translations, and then later on. And then you can see there is a differentiation between the religious and non-religious texts. So we were able to to be a bit more specific and really consider this added factor. And as you heard from the talk before, we made this the model more aware, and we added this this level of knowledge. And this proved to be successful. So comparing a genre-aware model, the top line you see here, with other models, we basically found the best performance. And so that was very nice and encouraging. And I learned a lot of lessons from this experience. Dealing with ancient languages isn't easy, but also it requires developing models that really embrace the variation, the idiosyncrasy of the corpus. So we need models that have knowledge rich, they're not knowledge rich. So in this case, with the example of genre. Now I'll take you to another set of methods that we applied for much more recent data. These are methods based on embedding technologies, and the basic idea is that you split your corpus in different time periods, you train different types of embeddings, and then you can compare the embedding or the representation of a word over time across these different spaces. So for example, here you see the example of gay, and the representation of gay shifting from being similar to words like cheerful and sweet to words like homosexual. So this is a well-known change that people were able to find with this methodology. And so what I did was try to test this methodology on a much larger corpus, but much, much smaller time frame. So pick the UK web archive, which covers late 90s and till 2013. And this was a time when a lot of words acquired a technology related meaning. And as you can see, we were able to find them, things like cloud or tweet or blackberry. And this is even more clear when we look at neighboring words. So in the case of BlackBerry, for example, in the earlier period, BlackBerry was similar to words like gooseberry, raspberry, and strawberry. But then at some point in coinciding with the launch of the BlackBerry mobile phone, its neighbors changed. And obviously the old meaning still exists, but because of the characteristics of this web corpus, the new meaning shows a clear shift in semantics. And I went on with an even smaller time frame and more recent data. We looked at Twitter 2011, 2017, a very large corpus of 1.6 billion tweets. And applying semantic change methods on this corpus actually showed interesting phenomena. So we didn't find the type of semantic change that we normally have in mind, but we found Twitter-specific jargon and changes that make a lot of sense probably if you spend a lot of time on Twitter, but also are interesting for computational social scientists. So for example, Vine has the common sense of the plant, but also was the name of a video hosting platform. So if we look at the time series of its change, you can see the blue line measures the semantic change score, and the red lines is just the frequency. And around the time when this platform was launched, we can really observe this change. And similarly for other words that we won't have much time to look into. Finally, I'll just take you through my last project, which was pushing the boundaries even further. And this time we looked at emoji. And there's of course a big question around whether emoji counts as language. So we decided to apply similar techniques on the semantic change of emoji. And we found that emoji can be divided into different types of categories depending on the patterns of semantic change. So for example, the pumpkin emoji goes through periodic changes, whereas the skull emoji underwent a kind of gradual shift from a literal sense of death towards figurative sense of dying of laughter or embarrassment. So we're able to measure these changes even for things that are not really words. They are a new emerging entity. And they are a nice example or opportunity really to study semantic change, because emoji, for emoji, we have complete corpus. So we can find all the times when an emoji was used just by collecting all the social media data. Whereas for language, it's much harder. Of course, we never can capture all language. And so we ask the question whether an emoji is meaning changes like a word's meaning. There's not that much time to talk about this, but we also tested some established hypotheses around, for example, whether concrete emoji show more or less diverse context compared to words. I can get back to this if there's time later. I just want to finish with a little summary of all the things I learned from this. And it really showed me how, depending on the scale and the audience of the research, the methods tend to change. So for contemporary large data sets on very short time periods, we can afford to be quite brutal in our methodology and use, for example, embedding technologies and little bit processing to really find a semantic change. But that type of change that we find is sometimes ephemeral and involves identities, not the type of change that is lasting and established as in historical texts. So what to expect in the future? Well, I would hope the two perspectives will converge, because there is definitely room for bringing together different communities that work at different scales, so historical versus contemporary texts, and really combine the two. So for example, the knowledge-rich approaches could really improve contemporary views on semantic change. So I'll finish here, and I'm looking forward to questions.